This is The Strategy Inside Everything. I'm Adam Pierno. All right. Welcome back to another episode of The Strategy Inside Everything. I'm really glad to be back. I have an exciting conversation with today's guest who is going to illuminate a kind of really interesting part of our work to you guys all today. I have today the founder and managing director of Applied Design Work, Mr. Brad Scott. Brad, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
Brad, it's so great for you to make time. I know we were scheduled, but had to reschedule. So I appreciate you finding another window for us to speak.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking to you because you have done a lot of amazing work, but there's one particular case study that we're going to jump into as a launching point for your process, your method. And I'm just interested in learning more about how you think.
That's great.
Yep. Before we do that, would you mind giving people a sense of your career and how you got to where you are now? What did you do before you founded Applied Design Works?
It's a great question. I mean, I've had kind of an interesting journey. I actually studied interior design back in the 90s. And in doing that, started learning a lot about what was called universal design, which was really looking at built spaces and understanding how people navigate through them and basically eliminating barriers, right? So at the time, ADA was, it was really under review. We were starting to talk about it. And the school that I went to, University of Akron, which is a crazy little school anyway, one of the professors there was really into ADA and universal design, which was really assuming it any point, if you design for everybody, you will help everybody. So for example, a doorknob, if you have to grab and twist a doorknob and you have mobility issues with your hand, that's a very difficult thing. So by having either a lever or a bump, you can enter a building or egress from a building very easily. But it translates to having a baby in your arms or having groceries in your arms too.
Yeah, it serves everybody.
It serves everybody. So it was a really kind of important part of my curriculum, was like really looking at, those things. So it's like good design will benefit everyone. So it was at the exact same time that the internet was taking off. So, I mean, I remember meeting with my advisor, and my advisor said to me, you got to get into this internet thing. Like, this is going to be big. And I kind of jokingly said, for what? And he's like, no, this will be your career. Like, trust me. Because it was about, 95-ish. And I was like, all right. So I checked it out and I figured out pretty quickly that a lot of the principles that we were learning inside of interior design with space planning and programming could actually be applied to information design and to, the emerging World Wide Web and trying to help people navigate through information and information spaces. So that actually led me out to San Francisco. I moved out to San Francisco and was very fortunate to be in San Francisco when basically the whole, dot-com internet boom happened. So I never worked as an interior designer. I immediately went into basically UI design and information design for a small little startup that did some really cool stuff. And did that for a couple of years, and then ended up joining a company that's called Landor, which is a really large branding and communications company. And branding, obviously logos, things like that, but the systems behind it. So I ended up joining Landor as a design director, and in my course at Landor, switched over to strategy. We were finding that a lot of the system side of what a brand identity is really kind of translated the stuff I was doing for, inside of interior design and UI, UX stuff, actually translated into doing some pretty interesting things for like business strategy. Like how do you start to solve like increasingly complex business problems by using basically the creative method and thinking about things in a little bit of a different way versus like just spreadsheets. So I was at Landor for a long time. I thought I was going to be at Landor for like 2 years. I'm like, if I get 2 years out of this, it's going to be awesome. I ended up being there for 16. It was amazing. I couldn't believe it. Worked across three different regions. I was in San Francisco, moved to Cincinnati, and then to New York City. And then it was about 7 years ago that Craig Doby, who's the other founder of Applied Designworks, we decided to start Applied because we wanted to really get into the nitty gritty of both communication, strategy, and implementation. And it was the implementation side that really excited us, because what we were finding was there was a lot going on inside the communications and design world, but it wasn't necessarily getting translated, like literally down to like the engraving on things or product design or
the fleshed out expression of what it feels like in the user's hand or in the marketplace directly.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you got it. It was like, you know, it was like tangible. It was like, we wanted to be able to like see the work, like manifest itself, you know, with whoever had to interact with it.
Your work at Landor, was it kind of the whole branding process, systems process, but then a playbook that gets handed off to the client, the brand, and the agencies that create the expression or do the work that they need to do?
Yeah, that's correct. And you know, and it depended on the engagement. I mean, some engagements went really deep and some stayed at a more like playbook level. So it depended. I think what we were finding was increasingly with the clients that we were working with, because at the time we were working with the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey on the redevelopment of the World Trade Center, what was beginning to be required by those types of clients was going very deep into the implementation of the design. And it was like, and I think that people often get implementation confused with just production. And implementation is like an incredibly strategic process, right? Because it's not only about getting the thing produced, but it's like, how does it actually reflect the brand, right? Like what about the branding comes to life in this thing coming into the world? So there's a part of it that's like quite literally just about producing it and getting it done. But there's also a huge part of it that's about, okay, who are we going to partner with? Does that make sense for the branding? Is that cost effective? Does that, you know, meet the business requirements?
Yeah, all the variables.
And those are very kind of, those are incredibly complicated issues that are often, that can be sometimes difficult to be working inside of a more specific agency, right? So like when you're working with like a landlord that's very specifically around branding, and you start getting into these areas that require, you know, new skill sets, new people, and new understanding of like legal requirements and all of that, that can, you know, get pretty expensive pretty quickly. And we wanted to go deeper into that area. So that's why we started Applied.
That's really interesting. And how long has Applied been in business?
It's our sixth anniversary was this past March. So we're at 6.5 years old.
Yeah. So the project that caught my eye was your work on development of a typeface.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That is something pretty unique about it. I think the name sort of gives it away, but Atkinson Hyperlegible. Mm-hmm. When I started reading about that and I watched a talk that you gave about the development of that typeface, it really sparked something for me, not just in the solution that it provides, but kind of the thought that goes into it. And I mm-hmm. wanted you to catch people up on what Atkinson Hyperlegible is, and then we can jump in after we learn a little bit more about that to the process.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, what Atkinson Hyperlegible is a font. Just that simple. It's, we're used to them. We all pick them. We all look at them. We interact with the written word every single day. The difference with it, though, is it is a font that was optimized for people with vision impairment. Mm-hmm. It was really looking at typefaces and saying, okay, how do we create something that is both readable and hyper-legible, but is also aesthetically interesting? It's not just, you know, ugly, but it's like something that people would want to use. And kind of goes back to that universal design idea, right? Like you don't have to, things can be accessible and still be aesthetically interesting.
Yeah.
So that was it at its most kind of basic level. It's a font that is easy to read.
Yeah. And so if you look at it, I'll obviously link to it here, but mm-hmm. Where people can see a sample and download it. If you look at it, you just made a lot of choices that seem really obvious, like clear separations between commonly confused characters, mm-hmm. like uppercase I, lowercase L, the numeral one, the capital B and numeral eight are other examples that are mm-hmm. showcased right away. How much, like, where did you start? And how did you get to those choices between what is aesthetically interesting and what is really necessary?
Well, it's interesting because where it started wasn't with a font at all, to be honest with you. It started with a branding project, and the Braille Institute, who's based out of Southern California, they're coming on their 100-year anniversary.
Yep.
And they were instrumental in Braille literacy and making Braille affordable. To people, because at the time, 100 years ago, Braille presses were incredibly expensive. You can imagine just like the massiveness of like transcribing, say, the Bible, which is the first thing they transcribed. It was like fit in a giant room, and they would like lend it out to people. And in doing that, they were also, huge advocates for Braille literacy. So getting legislation that, to teach, children that are born without sight how to use Braille. So that was a big part of their mission at the very beginning. And what was great was they were incredibly effective, along with a lot of other people, in early intervention. So if you have a child or you lose your sight as a kid, the state will provide Braille literacy. So what had happened over the course of their 100-year history was, it was obviously all about Braille and Braille literacy, but they had started to have a lot of people coming to them and their centers for vision impairment, right? So there's this kind of really interesting thing that's happening, which is, as a population, we're living longer.
Yeah.
And because of that, we're starting to run into, aging issues. We talked about a couple earlier, I'm a runner who's losing my knee's starting to wear out. But you start to see it, like your eyesight starts to go, and you start to get blurry eyesight, or unfortunately, you can also like have disease that can affect your eyes very quickly.
Absolutely.
That lead to vision impairment. And a lot of the strategies that they were teaching people who had complete vision loss were applicable to people who had partial vision loss, to be able to maintain their independence and their life, basically. And it was simple things, right? It was how to cook, how to set up your kitchen so that you can continue to enjoy cooking. Things like how to fold your money so that you know the differences between dollars, tens, fives, and hundreds, right? Because in the US, all of our currency is the same size. So it's difficult. So like, what are strategies that you can do to be who you are? So they were coming on to their 100th anniversary, and they wanted to rebrand and really kind of acknowledge low vision, right? Because a huge majority of what they were doing was focused on the low vision community. They needed some help with just, how do we rebrand it? How do we take what we've done? How do we take this 100 years of like really robust and rich history and get people to understand that it's not just about Braille, but it's about
this expansion of their mission. Yeah,
that's correct. And so that was when we got retained, and we were retained very simply to do the branding exercise. And what happened in doing that exercise was, you go through the whole process. It's like mission, vision, values. We'd come up with a whole, basically their tagline. And then when we got into the actual visual, identity piece of the logo, which, by the way, I don't have it on my screen, I would share it with you. It's basically a B and a dot. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a B, a numeral B. And that's, and the dots, the two dots from the zero and the B, or the center of the B to the top, is actually an I in Braille. So that's the connection. And in doing that, we were trying to find a font that we thought would be beneficial and reflective of their mission, right? And there wasn't one. Mm-hmm. So what you could find was, you'd see things like Helvetica, but there's a ton of harmony in Helvetica, which makes it, it's a beautiful font. Like, by no means is this panning Helvetica.
Yeah, don't you dare speak ill of Helvetica, Brad. People will...
Yeah, I mean, I'll get hate mail if you can't believe. So that's not what we're talking about. But, you know, Helvetica is this font that's all based on harmony, right? And what makes it so beautiful is they're phenomenal letter forms, but it's harmonized. When you see it as a family, you see the harmony.
Yeah, there's no dissonance in it whatsoever.
That's correct.
And that's what makes it work.
That's what makes it beautiful, but that's also what makes it hard for somebody with low vision because there isn't letter differentiation. So what we quickly came to the conclusion on was like, how can we with integrity spec something that we know isn't quite performing the way we need it to perform given the mission of Braille Institute and that this is going to be the big launch for the 100-year anniversary?
How often when you do branding work do you commission a new font or create your own typeface versus modify? You know, a logo is one thing where you may just modify something, but actually, you know, how often do you turn to the creation of a whole new font family and typeface?
This is the first time for us. I mean, we've worked, you know, in previous lives, Craig and I both, worked at Landor together and we had some large corporate clients where, you know, you commission a bespoke font. But 9 times out of 10, it's based off of something else, right? There's little tweaks to the character sets to make it their own. And you know, that's not uncommon at like the large corporate level. And when I say large corporate, you're talking Fortune 100 and above. So this was the first time that we've ever done like, just, this is like a wholesale design from the ground up. Mm-hmm. I have to say, this goes back to what you're saying. We kind of naively took it on. Like, well, how hard could it be? Right. I mean, and the craziest part of it was, I mean, we're not typographers, we're designers. We know about type, but we're not typographers. And in fact, you know, we knew kind of going into it that what we were taking on was going to be breaking a lot of rules, in typography, because a lot of the rules are about harmony. And we were, you know, intentionally taking on something that was kind of like, you know, mixing and matching a bunch of different styles to like come up with something, you know, to generate both legibility inside of each one of the characters, but also differentiation between the letter sets, which, going back to what I was saying about Helvetica, you know, that is all about harmonization. That's about like this set of characters that
you need to like create that disruption so that the eye quickly spots the differences that we need to see to differentiate.
That's correct.
So did you engage a typographer for the project to help, or did you tackle it, you know, with the Braille Institute as a partner and guide them through the decisions that you were confronting?
It was the latter. I mean, we all kind of took it on, right? We were very fortunate to have a very supportive, I mean, it was developed for Braille. So they were, of course, like, I remember when we presented it, they were just kind of like, are we really going to take this on? We're like, yeah, we're really going to take this on. Like, don't worry.
Did they think it was too big of a thing, or did they say, no, this makes sense. We understand why.
Oh no, it was the latter. They completely understood it. I think we were all a little naive as to what the effort was going to be, right? It was kind of like, it seems like such a simple thing. And probably you're like, yeah, we'll design a font, right? And I mean, look, we're seasoned graphic designers. I mean, I'm using hyperbole slightly, but we really didn't think it was going to, you know, be as kind of complicated as it was to get it done. But they were game, right? They're like, this is great. Yeah, you're absolutely right. We need to do this. And they saw the strategic value in it too, because what they wanted to do is they wanted to contribute to their community. And, you know, the thing that's remarkable from their side is like, this thing is freely available. Like their goal was like, if we're going to do this, we're going to distribute it and we're going to allow anybody to use it without restriction. So it's like completely commercially available. And now because they want it out there, right? They want to be able to help their community. And this was going to be one mechanism that was going to help them. They do that through training, they do it through, you know, things like the font. So they saw the value in it pretty quickly. On top of the fact that it looked cool, right? Like that was the other part, was it was reflective of, you know, who they were and where they wanted to go the next 100 years.
That's really cool that they got right on board and recognized the value that it would have to a broader community.
Mm-hmm.
Did you? Go ahead.
No. Go ahead.
When you say it was, you know, a bigger scale project than you thought, how much bigger was it? You know, once you started getting into it, was it twice the work, 10 times the work, or was it really just, oh, there's so many little details that we have to focus on that we hadn't thought of?
It was kind of all of the above. I can't really say, like, we knew that it was going to be a lot of work going into it. It's kind of, you know, you just don't know until you're in it. Like, that's the thing. Like, you know, intuitively, you're like, because I know typographers and I've read stories and, you know, it takes years to develop a font face. So like, we weren't naive to kind of like what it was, but you just don't know what it is until you're in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And so I can't really say it took three or four times longer than what we expected. I think it's just like, it's like any like really nuanced project. It's just, there are a gazillion different details. And we were very lucky because, like, so Elliot Scott, who is the creative director on the project, you know, he's really in the type. So, you know, he kind of laid the foundation down. And then Megan, who's on our team as well, she was a recent graduate from Western Michigan, and they have an amazing type program. So just by like absolute serendipity, she had joined our team. And so she kind of knew what to do. So
that came in handy.
Yeah. And she's like, and Megan Eisworth, and it's, you know, she came into it. She's like, well, what do you mean? I'm going to design time. Like, our professor said, you're never going to do this in your career. And
it's know, her first it's project.
Like, it's like one of her first projects. So we were lucky that we had a very like enthusiastic, you know, person come in who was also willing to take it on. And then this guy, Linus Baumann, who he essentially became, he's like the technical person who we brought in. So between the three of them, they were enthusiastic and knew how to pull it together.
Yeah, that's really interesting collection of happenstance that all worked to create this beautiful solution.
I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, it was a bit serendipitous that the pieces came together the way they did.
Yeah. If it met the opportunity at the perfect time, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
So how, I had to ask you before we started speaking, you know, are you visually impaired? With the answer is no. And I think the greater question I have, and this is a question for you and your whole team, is how do you approach a problem that you yourself don't have? You know, where do you start with that? How do you think about it? Because it's not just designing of a typeface. In this case, it is. But it sounds like at Applied Design Works, you guys are solving all kinds of challenges beyond design, you know, into branding. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the idea of putting yourself in someone else's position, I wanted to pick your brain on that and hear where you start.
I think it comes from the beginner's mindset, right? And I just totally ripped that off from my business partner, Craig. He talks about it, but you know, Craig articulates it really well. I think as a group of people, we just have a beginner's mindset, which is just to not assume we know the answer going into it. We have a lot of experience that we can bring to bear on a project, which I think gives us and our clients the confidence that we'll be able to solve for it. But you know, we really do approach things like from like nothing sacred, right? We're not holding convention and saying, oh, because this has happened, we're going to do this. It really is trying to like get to kind of what the core of what it is that we're trying to solve. If you don't mind me going off on a tangent, I can give you like an example. And this is not really an applied example, but I think it's applicable to applied. So I have an 11-year-old son. I think I was telling you I cannibalized his computer to be able to make sure the audio was good today. He fancies himself a game designer, and he's very excited and enthusiastic about
What's
it.
What's his platform? Is Roblox or something else?
He's actually using Python in a thing called Pygame, which is using the Python language. But there are these things called game jams that they have. And he just completed one, which was for Team Seas, which is Mark Rober's big thing for cleaning out the ocean. and Mr. Beast. And there's another one that he looked at, and it was for people who are visually impaired, developing a game for people who are visually impaired. And I was like, what? This is crazy. I mean, this has literally happened at dinner last night. And he's like, hey, Dad, I want to do this. I'm really interested in it. I'm like, okay, cool. Well, let's talk about it. And as we were talking about it, what was interesting was it was Stacy, my wife, Ben, and myself at dinner talking about it. We were talking about the game in the context of what a sighted person would do. And I think so we were talking about, well, how do we get the keyboard to work? And can we do a maze game? And can we do like a Pong type game, or is it like a Simon Says type of thing? And what started to kind of emerge was like, we were thinking about it from the context of a sighted person. And what we should be thinking about is in the context of like not being encumbered by sight.
Yeah.
Right. And
oh, so like, and repositioning the idea of sight from a mandatory construct into freedom from it.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Go on.
So it was like, well, we're assuming that sight is the right way to do this, but there's a superpower potentially in not having the sight. So what would that be? Like what would you do if that was the thing? If you had like this amazing oratory, you know, audible sense, like what game would come from that? Like how would you use tone? How would you use tactile qualities?
Proximity, you know, especially with all the work that Bose and Apple are doing with that full room sound that they're able to, that acoustic benefit that they've been improving on.
Exactly. Like a three-dimensional soundscape or whatever it is. But my point being is like, we were thinking about it as like a loss of something and not as an absence of something.
Yeah. Right.
And once you start having that shift, like once you can start thinking about it in those contexts of like, that is normal, right? Like it's not abnormal. We're thinking about it in the I think people do this intuitively. Like you think of it as like, oh, if you can't see, that's not normal, right? Or that's this hindrance. But the reality of it is like some people have poor vision. That's totally 100% normal.
Yep.
So like, why are we thinking of it in the context of it not being? And I think once you start to make those empathetic and sympathetic shifts, some pretty interesting stuff can start to emerge, because it just doesn't like, it's not a condition. It's like, there was this guy, and I might have this slightly wrong, but he was like a rock climber, mountain climber, outdoors person. And he was, I want to say he was either missing his leg. I think he was missing his leg.
Okay.
And he had this whole thing. He's like, well, my prosthesis can actually enable what I want to do. So he had like ones that were like really tall and some that were really short and some that had like ice climbing gear built into them. Right. Like instead of trying to like mimic whatever the missing limb was, he's like, I'm going to augment that. I'm going to like use that to my advantage.
Yeah.
And turn that into like my superpower, right? I climb, I ice climb, I do these things. Why wouldn't I take advantage of this? Like, why wouldn't I just, I'm not encumbered now by this.
I don't have to rely on my digits here. I can
augment that in some way. And he did. And it was pretty phenomenal. And I think it's like, when you start to like think in those terms, then I think that starts to kind of unlock some of these solutions.
How hard is it to get to that place? I mean, how much focus does it take, or is it research, or is there a process that you go through? It sounds like in the case of the game you just described, it was, you know, a conversation around a dinner table. So there's focus because everybody is discussing the same challenge, but for brand, how much focus is it?
I think it is that conversation, right? I mean, I at least for Applied, like I can't speak for other agencies, but for our agency, it's that conversation. And I think that it's that curiosity and it's that beginner's mindset that allows things to get on the table or allows the conversation to take a twist and a turn. And it's having the confidence that you're going to get to the solution, right? Yeah. And I think that's kind of sometimes, you know, we're very lucky. We have some pretty amazing clients who buy into the idea. And we joke around with them a lot. We're like, hey, this is a messy process. We're not the people who are going to put a little bow on it and say, here you go. It's like, you know, we're going to take you along on this journey with us. And, you know, we just have to trust that we're going to get there, because there's going to be moments where it's not quantifiable, right? It's just, there's moments where there's a spark and that helps to bring us to the solution. And, you know, our goal is to get to that spark, and that spark could be from our team, or it could be from our client team, or we like to think of it as, you know, our teams together. And I think just being kind of open to like wherever that comes from, and being able to create an environment that allows, I would say, both the safety, but the confidence that you're going to come to the place that you need to come to for whatever the problem is.
That's the second time you mentioned that confidence. How important is that as a factor to facilitate or get you closer to that spark?
I think it's critical. I really do. I think if you're worried you're not going to get there, you're not going to get there. If you're confident that you will get there, but you're not entirely sure how you're going to get there, you'll get to the solution. Because otherwise, you just start thinking about different things. You start to question it, right? You start to, are we going down the right path? Are we not going down the right path? This is starting to get a little uncomfortable. And it's really just, it's having assurance that you're going to reach the place you need to reach.
Yeah. And you have to just go down the path until you decide this isn't the right path. Let's try another path versus be scared the entire way down.
Yeah. And that's a really important distinction, right? It's, I think a lot of that, it's being able to come up with ideas that are viable, but then also not holding them so precious that you go down a path too far with something that, you know, you might think it's going to work, and you get into it and you're like, it's just not going to work.
Yeah.
Like, you have to at some point just be like, it's not going to work. Like,
right.
This isn't the one. And that's okay. Like, that's totally fine. And guess what? We didn't waste time pursuing it, because in pursuing it, it taught us that it wasn't the right one.
Yes.
So now let's look at that and say, okay, well, what about it isn't correct, so that we can pursue the next thing and
what evaluate can we learn
against it. Yeah.
How many staff do you have at Applied?
We have, I hesitated there because we've been growing quite a bit.
No, ballpark.
We're about 15 people. Right,
yeah.
Now.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so do you, the reason I ask is, do you hire for beginner's mind as part of the interview process, or as part of the type of people you're bringing on that are willing to dig down for these types of conversations?
I think subconsciously we do.
Yeah.
I think the question, you know, we can pick up pretty quickly on somebody's orientation, you know, by describing how they approach processes and things like that. So I would say yes, but we don't have like a list. There's not like a checklist that we go, oh, this is beginner mindset. I think it's a feel.
Yeah. It hasn't been formalized. But it's something like the person you mentioned who had helped design the typeface that had just come from the program for type. Mm-hmm. That's pretty lucky, but also that it sounds like they had the mindset to break it down with you and do the full exploration of like, all right, let's start from scratch.
Yeah. And I think though, yes, that's true. But I also think like as a group, like as a company, we really are looking for like broad experience. Right. So like myself being, you know, I came out of interior design into like UI design. I have no right talking about typography, right? I didn't study it. I know nothing about it. But there's other parts of my training that are applicable to business and brand strategy and ultimately design. And
yes.
And I think, you know, just that's, you know, we're not necessarily just looking for like graphic designers when we go to hire. We're looking for, you know, people who have technical skill sets, but that have an interesting point of view on things as well.
Yeah. You don't want people that are too dogmatic about the only way to do things is this way that this process that we've developed. You kind of want to create the room in the process for that. Scribbly.
Yeah. For us, that's really important. Right. And I know there's other, and it's not a judgmental call. There's other agencies that are very, you know, they're very specific about how they approach things, and that works for them and that works for their clients. It just doesn't work for us and our clients. Because like we're often like so often our clients bring us in because they're clear on what they want to achieve, but they're not necessarily clear on the tactics to get there. Like they're usually very driven and very specific on, okay, as a business, this is what we need to do. Now, what we need to do is understand, like, we need you to help us to understand how to get there. And, yeah, and we'll work together on doing that.
They tell you the what and you tell them the how.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes they tell us the how too.
But, yeah. You know. But it sounds like the types of clients that are attracted to you are the types that get, oh, this is what we thought we wanted, but we understand this new idea will help us get to the goal in a different way, in a better way, or it's worth exploring.
Yeah. That, yes. Yes. That's exactly right. It's funny. You should, I hadn't really thought about it, but yeah, that's exactly it. We're very lucky that the clients that we've been able to work with, you know, they're kind of, I always joke around, they're open for, you know, they're open for a good time, right? Like they want to like, they want to achieve the goal, but they're also kind of wanting to go on the journey as well.
How much are they a part of the work? Are you an open studio with where they're actually working with you in workshops, or is it more your team bringing them answers after your exploration and the process that, however messy it may be, that takes place at Applied? Or I'm guessing it depends.
I think it's a blend. I mean, there is a certain amount of synthesis. It's funny. I was just thinking through it because I think we tend to share a lot more than, you know, than other agencies, but we don't share everything.
Yeah.
So what I mean by that is there's a lot of synthesis that, I mean, let's face it, our clients are hiring us to, you know, help them make decisions. So we want to curate what's coming in. But we tend to share quite a bit and then bring them into the process. And a lot of times, like I'm just thinking through it, we just did a creative review with one of our big clients. And it's, you know, we brought six concepts into that. And Craig sets it up really well. He's like, today's meeting isn't just about what's working, but about the things that maybe aren't, so that we can start to together understand like where you know, what it is we're trying to achieve. So, you know, it's a broader spectrum of work. And of course we want them to go, that's the one, but that's not really how it works. It's more like, that one feels really good. And this one, whoa, I don't know about that.
And here's why you need to, and here's what we don't, here's what's not clicking for us, or here's what we're objecting to.
Correct. And a lot of times what we find with the, ooh, I don't know about that is, you know, the question starts to be asked, well, is it because it's mechanically not going to work, or is it because you're uncomfortable? And, you know, well, mechanically we've got to fit it into this small thing. Okay. Well, that's a different story, but a lot of times what you'll start to understand is that it just makes, I don't know, it doesn't, you know, it causes me a little bit of like, I don't know how to assess it. I don't know. I don't have the vocabulary for it yet. So then, you know, that starts to help us understand too. That may be a very good solution. We just need to help people understand why it is. Like a lot of times the uncomfort just comes from not having the vocabulary to be able to like express its benefit. So then, you know, in that particular scenario, it's really helping everybody in the room have the words or the point of view to say, okay, well, this one, you know, it does this thing, but that thing is good. And this is why.
Yeah. I mean, it's like why classical art is easier to discuss than modern art, where you have a mm-hmm. vocabulary for why the girl with the pearl earring is beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's not always so easy to explain cubism.
That's true.
What moves me about that? Or let's debate it. You really mm-hmm. don't, if you're not in an art historian or an art critic that's been classically trained, it's hard to know where to start and how to explain your feelings about it or how to move mm-hmm. that conversation forward. Same thing.
Exactly. And let's, you know, the other thing we have to realize is like, we're visual designers. This is like our bread and butter. It's our vocabulary. And it's our job, I think, to help the people that we're working with build the vocabulary so they can start to articulate like what they're feeling and why it would work or why they're hesitating with it. You know, and that's a big part of what we do, because we think that that's, I don't think we would have ever, I mean, look, we Braille, they're super ambitious, they're great people to work with. But, you know, there's moments where you're like, are we doing the right thing? Like, is this the right thing to do? There's always that moment where you're like, yeah. Ooh. And that's the moment that you have to be in a co-creation mode with the people on the team, because at some point they're going to get stopped in the hall one-on-one with somebody that you want them to have the confidence that this is the right decision that needs to be made. And you don't do that by just working in a vacuum or going ta-da to a client, at least not in our opinion. Our opinion is let's get into it together. And then you can kind of work through the issues. Cause like we present stuff too. I mean, look, we never present anything that we don't want to see in the world, right? That's like everything we present is like, if you choose any one of these, we're going to be happy that you chose it. There's just, each one might do something differently.
Right.
And we don't necessarily agree to it. Like, you know, across the team, like there's certain ones that we think are do something a little bit differently that we think is more important than, you know, than what Craig thinks. And we let them see that conversation because it helps them with that conversation. Right. Like that's the thing. It helps everybody involved to say, well, okay, I saw Brent and Craig talking in debate. I mean, like they're the agency and they're debating this. Like this is normal.
So we can be comfortable debating as well.
Yeah. And we can also hear the reason why they're advocating for one over another, right? Like, okay, well, so this one's really about this and this one's really about this. And then it just becomes a decision on, but which one do you want to be about? Mm-hmm. And that type of, you know, dialogue, I think helps everybody. So that, because it's like I said, it's a co-creation. If you don't have buy-in from the people who have hired you to work for them, then you're not going to, I don't know that the project's really going to ever be that successful.
Or have the longevity of success. Even if it's successful out of the gate, it'll start to get picked out over time.
Yeah, it'll start to get diluted very quickly.
Exactly.
And that's okay. Like, I mean, this is the thing that we talk about all the time. I mean, I know we're supposed to be talking about hyper-legible, but this is the design process, right? I mean, hyper-legible has been picked apart, you know, and it's going to get picked apart. The good news is that, you know, Braille Institute stands behind it.
Wouldn't it be beautiful if the people picking it apart, and I'm guessing some of the people who are doing this are doing what I'm about to suggest, is, oh, this group took a swing at creating this font that is better mm-hmm. for legibility, but I don't like this about it. Here's my version.
Yeah.
And now there's two, and now there's four, and now there's eight. And over time there's more, and they're all designed with the same goal in mind. I mean, that's the dream.
That's the dream. I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, it's like we keep joking around about it. We're like, is hyper-legible now like a category of fonts? should it be? And it gets back to exactly what you're saying. So you know, Atkinson might not be what you want, but like the principles behind it and the conversation behind it is what's important, right?
Yes.
And I think that that's kind of the amazing part of what Braille saw. At the very beginning, I don't think we had quite articulated that yet, but I think intuitively they saw that it's a conversation that needs to be had, right?
Yeah.
Like let's talk about it. Like these issues are real issues. And this is a vehicle to help solve those for some people. Because the other thing about Atkinson Hyper-Legible is it works for some people and it doesn't for others. And that's totally fine. Like, it's just one more thing that an occupational therapist has at their disposal to help somebody.
Yes.
And if it works, that's awesome. If it doesn't and Times New Roman works better, that's great too. That's totally fine. But let's have the conversation.
Yeah. Like, now you have two tools instead of just one tool.
That's correct. And it's also like, they're not, it gives people a basis to your point to say, okay, I don't quite like the style or the way you've styled it, or I don't totally agree with the way you've done the J. That's great. Then let's come up with the next one.
Yeah.
But let's think of it as a category of fonts that really is about access, right? I mean, that's the thing, right? It's like hyper-legible is by no means the end all be all on this. We're just hoping that it's the beginning of the conversation that helps with access, right? It's like it professionally, and like your avocations and your vocations, like if this helps somebody, continue to read, that's awesome. If this helps somebody be able to be like, look at the instrumentation on their dashboard better so mm-hmm. they can continue to drive with more confidence, that's awesome. If this helps a programmer, if all of a sudden it gets made into a monospace font that's in a compiler for like my son who's in the Python, that all of a sudden you can continue on with your livelihood longer.
Yeah.
It's amazing. But it doesn't have to be Atkinson hyperlegible, right?
And Brad, even if it doesn't, if it sparks someone to think about, and have the conversation about visual access, that could be enough for that person to start down a path of a new thought about access and equity for visually impaired people.
That's exactly right. So. And it kind of goes back to what you're talking about, with the beginner's mindset, right? It's like, if it sparks a conversation for somebody to get more curious about what vision impairment really is, that's huge, because vision impairment isn't just about blurry vision, right? There's so many different things, and it kind of goes back to how do we start the project? It's you got to understand what those are. It's not just that it's blurry. It's that some people can only see out of their peripheral vision. Some people can only see in the center. Some people have little bits and particles that are floating in their field of vision. So they have to move their head back and forth to be able to see it. And it's once you kind of understand that it's not just one thing, then that helps you to start to solve the problem. And kind of to your point, if somebody's inspired to go and really learn about it, it's huge. It's a big deal, because it's not just about the written word. It's about navigation through physical spaces as well.
Yep.
So
that's really great work. And
thank you.
I'm really glad I was able to connect with you. This is a great conversation. Mm-hmm. So Brad, thank you for making time for me.
Yeah, likewise. It's been fantastic. And thanks for giving us the opportunity to talk about it.
Of course.
Always fun.
Where can people, I will link to Atkinson Hyperlegible, but where can people mm-hmm. find you online?
So you can download the font from Braille Institute. So brailleinstitute.org site. There's a drop-down menu. It says free font. You'll have a list to that. That's for a desktop install. And we're very excited to also let everybody know that it's available through Google Fonts.
So awesome.
The benefit of that is if you use the Google platform, you can set your default to be Atkinson Hyperlegible without having to install it to the machine. So that's the other vehicle as well. And then, of course, applied. We don't have a link to it, but we don't allow you to download it because it's property of Braille. But you can come to our site and we have a link that will go to the download site from Braille.
Awesome. Well, again, mm-hmm. I really appreciate your time and really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right.
All right.
Bye. Strategy Inside Everything is produced by me, Adam Kierno. If you liked what you heard, please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps. If someone shared this with you and you're just not sure where you could find it, you can go to specific.substack.com and sign up there to get episodes before everybody else. For more information about me, Adam Pierno, you can go to adampierno.com. There's information about my books, my speaking, and my strategy work. Have an idea for a guest? Send it my way. Just go to adampierno.com and you'll find a form there that will help you connect. Thanks for listening.